Russ, thanks for that really generous introduction. And I'd like to thank the Wild Selection Committee for providing me the opportunity to give this lectureship. It's really quite an honor. It's also really great to look out over the audience and see so many people that I've worked with or known for 30 or 40 years in some cases. And I'd like to thank you as well, because I have benefited from your advice and your occasional criticism over the years, and I feel really privileged to be considered part of this group. So Russ has given you the topic for today. We're going to talk a little bit about waste recycling and forests and their role. And I'm going to start by giving you a very quick overview of the presentation. I'm going to have a brief introduction, talking a little bit about waste management history. I'm going to talk about the significance of forest land application systems in the current day. Then I'm going to cover a little bit about system design and remediation pathways for those of you that haven't actually designed any systems. I have several case studies that I want to talk about for nitrogen and phosphorus that will explain a little bit about maybe some issues we have and how we do our designs. And finally, I'm just going to touch for a minute on phytoremediation and the role of trees in phytoremediation. So waste management issues have been with us since we essentially gave up hunter-gatherer existences and started moving into cities. In 4000 BC in Babylon, large homes actually had an opening in the floor of small interior rooms that they used to collect their waste. Major public areas had systems that sort of moved the waste away from the centralized areas. The Isle of Crete in 1700 before the current era had systems that were developed, plumbing and drainage systems. Open sewers were made of stone, and the royal household had something sort of equivalent to a flushing toilet. As we move into ancient Rome, the Cloaca Maxima, the great sewer, carried storm drainage from an effluent from Rome's public latrines into the River Tiber. Cloacina was the goddess that watched over and protected this system. It was considered so important. But despite these kind of notable exceptions, for the most part, through the Middle Ages and Renaissance, pretty much waste disposal meant opening a window or finding a yard. And because of that, in Britain in the 1300s, they actually passed a law: you can't throw night waste out the window and perhaps hit your neighbor. These really started to change. Things really started to change in the 1850s and 1880s. Sir John Harrington actually was the inventor of the flush toilet in the 1500s. But in 1852, George Jennings took out a patent for the first flush-out toilet. And Sir Thomas Crapper popularized this with the improvements that really took us from the outhouse to the indoor plumbing. So by the 1900s, most urban areas really had a system for collecting waste and moving it from the city to the urban center. But in 1905 in the United States, only 95% of this urban population, their waste was actually treated. It pretty much went from the collection system directly into the river. This started to change in the 1940s with the passage of the Water Pollution Control Act. And then we had amendments in 1956 and in 1965. But the real change came in 1972 with the Water Pollution Control Act amendments. It was in 1972 that a couple things happened. One thing that occurred is sort of the development of a national pollutant discharge elimination system. And as part of that act, what was done was that you had money that went to communities for publicly owned treatment works. And there was also a provision in that act that sort of emphasized and encouraged the use of non-point discharge solutions, land application systems, to handle wastewater. And along with that, there was actually a 25% bonus in the amount of money or the amount of funding you could get to put in a land application system. So this was really a sea change in the way we looked at wastewater treatment. And then one of the highlights, this has to be the highlight, in 1981, the Corps of Engineers, USDA, through EPA, issued the process design manual for land treatment of wastewater. And this was only municipal wastewater, but indeed, it was this design manual that most states adopted and utilized not only for municipal wastewater, but actually for their industrial systems as well. So this was really a major step. This design manual has been updated. A new process design manual was published in 2006, which has now sort of been adopted by most communities and most states. But some of the major concepts from that 1981 manual actually have been passed through for now approaching 40 years. So we had these systems that were sort of developed in the 70s and 80s. The first question you might ask, you know, are forest land applications still significant? All we ever hear about right now is wetland systems, right? Everybody's talking about a wetland treatment system. So I thought, well, let's go and just find out how common these still are. Turns out that's not easy information to get. I can guarantee you there's nobody in the United States that knows how many forest land treatment systems there are. And the reason for that is because most states might report that they have a land application system, but they often don't report what type of crop that system is using. Indeed, if you want to find out what type of crop that system is using, you might have to go to the design manual, and that requires a Freedom of Information Act. And even if you get the design manual, many times it won't even include the crop in the design manual. So it's very, very difficult information to get. There are a couple of states that had a reasonably recent review. North Carolina, a report by Nielsen, listed 86 permits that covered about 3,500 hectares. And if you look in North Carolina, more than half of those municipal systems, so this is partial information, it's only municipal systems, more than half are actually still forest land treatment systems. Oregon also had a report that talked about 61 of their municipal systems, and they found that a little less than a quarter, maybe 20%, were actually forest land application systems. But I do put in this golf mix sort of thing, because almost anywhere you see a land treatment system with a golf course, you're going to have an adjacent forest, because if you need to spray wastewater, you don't want to spray it when people want to play golf, so you have that forest as sort of your backup system. In my own state of Georgia, I wanted to say, well, I can do a better job. I know everyone in the DNR, the DPH, and I could get some information. Yeah, they still wanted me to get a Freedom of Information Act to get this information. But what I was able to do is we had a spreadsheet with all of the currently permitted systems, the industrial systems and the municipal systems. And by using some information on the actual location, GIS system, I was able to locate those systems and in some cases determine from Google Maps whether those systems were agricultural, forest, or a mix. And then I also just started cold calling people that were responsible for the land application system. And it turns out in our state, agricultural, industrial systems, which include agriculture, right? They include the dairy farms, the chicken farms, the hog farms. About 15% of the industrial systems are still forested systems. You got another 15% or so that are mixtures of golf courses. Municipal systems, about a third of those systems are still forest land application systems. And some of these are quite big. The Dolphin system is over 4,000 hectares. So, we have these systems, many of them have been in place and been operating for 20 or 30 years. It might be worthwhile taking a look at how those systems were designed and how they have functioned over this long term. And so, when we look at least municipal wastewater, and to some extent industrial, but we would consider those perhaps a separate category, that, you know, three things. Water, nitrogen, phosphorus are going to be the land-limiting constituent, the constituent that is the one that tells you how much land you need to have. I'm not going to talk about water because that's another issue entirely. So I'm going to talk a little bit about nitrogen and phosphorus. So how do we model nitrogen and phosphorus for these systems, nitrogen and phosphorus renovation? Well, this is the kind of the net renovation pathways that are that are published in both the 81 and 2006 manuals. And you notice you have a wastewater input. You have nitrogen losses through denitrification, ammonia volatilization. You have a plant uptake component. You have a leaching component. All right? Now, if I were doing that slide and I'd asked my graduate class to describe the nitrogen cycle, they would have been missing some important things. First, we have plant uptake, but we also have return to the forest. So plant uptake is really net plant uptake. This box here that looks at the soil change, well, nitrogen in the soil is both an input and an output. It's in a dynamic balance. And so both of those directional arrows are important. And finally, sort of the one thing that never really is addressed in land application designs is, are we going to have any surface runoff? And I probably won't address very much of that either. So this is how it's designed. This is just how these end-loading design pathways actually look when we look at the 1981 and 2006 manuals. We have an input of nitrogen and wastewater, and we have some fates. We have biomass uptake, a change in soil storage, denitrification, volatilization, leaching to groundwater, and surface runoff. A couple comments about this design. This is actually an example. It comes right out of the design manual if you use the maximum rates of application. Notice that uptake rate, all right? Now, if you refer back to the graph I just showed you, that is considered net uptake, right? That's net uptake. I would suggest, and this is actually the table that's provided in both the 81 and 2006 manual, they suggest maximum net uptakes. And if you notice, for southern forests, we have southern pines with understory, 320 kilograms per hectare per year. Hybrid poplar, 300 to 400. A Doug fir plantation, 150 to 250. Eastern hardwoods, over 200. Now, the problem with those uptakes are, if you look at rapidly growing forests, this is the sea trees study in North Carolina, fertigation. The annual fertilization study that Nick Comerford did with the Gator Nationals, the work that was done at SUNY in New York with fertigation of salix, fertilization of poplar trees, none of those net uptakes really approaches anything like what's put in the design manuals. You know, 20 for loblolly pine, okay? For the poplar plantations, 86. So the populous site, reported by Fortier et al., 128. In fact, the only place you can find any net uptake exceeding what's put in the design manual is actually a poplar study done in Florida by Pat Minogue, where it was a 2.5-year or 2.2-year study, and he was accumulating crown and stem biomass in very closely planted poplar. Okay? So you have to say, well, they got this really high uptake. Where did it come from? Turns out it came from our friends. Wade Nutter, who I had an opportunity to work with for years, did an early study in Helen, Georgia. And what he had done, he applied wastewater from the municipality to a forest there. They did a fairly short-term study, and they found that they could apply nitrogen loadings up to 680 kilograms per hectare per year without having a negative impact on water quality. The cited study, which is what they used for the basis for giving you those values in the design manual, was short-term. It was only 2 to 3 years. Plus, they reported as uptake data, but indeed, the only data reported in the cited study is concentration data without vegetation mass. So really, the cited values are based on nitrogen ecosystem renovation and not uptake. In western forests, where did those numbers come from? Well, they came from Dale Cole. I wish Dale was here, because right now he'd be throwing things at me. But what he did is he studied a young Douglas fir and young poplar plantations. And the citation that they use in the design manual was the wastewater renovation capacity was nitrogen loadings up to 350 to 400 kilograms per hectare per year. Okay? Now, that study was a short-term study where they looked at 2 to 3 year uptake. So again, they're assimilating and growing crown. And the values that they're citing here were the values that Dale provided for ecosystem renovation based on what was applied and what came out the bottom at 1.8 meters. It was not for uptake. If you actually look at Dale's uptake numbers, it was 75 kilograms per hectare per year for a Douglas fir system and about 100 kilograms per hectare per year for poplar. So we start off with our design manuals having some pretty optimistic uptake values. And that's what they are. In the design manuals, very specifically, it's net nitrogen uptake. Now, we also have some other things in this design manual we might want to look at. The assumption in the 81 manual is that soil changes over the long term will balance out and they'll be, you know, zero. So we don't actually look at soil change in nitrogen when you apply wastewater. Denitrification could be about, you know, 15 to 25%. If you use 20 and the number I provided for uptake, you get about 64 kilograms per hectare per year. We don't get any credit for ammonia volatilization of forest systems because theoretically you don't get ammonia volatilization because the pH is too low. But as Miguel Cabrera has shown in some of his work, yeah, we can get, under certain conditions, get ammonia volatilization. And then leaching to groundwater. You don't get credit for leaching to groundwater, but in fact it's implicit in all designs because a design is considered working if you have less than 5 milligrams per liter of nitrate nitrogen in groundwater, because the drinking water standard is 10, and it's not until they hit that 5 milligrams per liter threshold that we start making changes to the way the system's operating. So that's sort of an implicit amount you can load to groundwater without having a problem. There were some changes made in the 2006 manual, and then this change was basically to lump the soil storage, denitrification, ammonia volatilization into one factor. And they sort of took soil out of it. The factor is based on the carbon to nitrogen ratio of the wastewater being applied and not on the actual site it's being applied to. There's some verbiage in the manual that says, oh yeah, you have to consider soils and other things, but this is actually the way, so it's an engineering approach, right? You have the carbon to nitrogen ratio. In any event, when you put that all out, you get some fairly high acceptable loading rates between 400 and maybe 500 kilograms per hectare. So, I wanted to look at some case studies where we actually had some information on how nitrogen has behaved over the long term rather than over the short term. And the first study I'm going to talk about is a case study in Clayton County, Georgia. I had the opportunity, because this was a system that Wade Nutter designed, I was able to go in there, and they were very, very helpful and very generous over the years. They allowed me to go in and do certain experiments and bring graduate students and bring undergraduates there. So it was a system that we have a pretty good amount of information on. It drains the southern area of Atlanta. Prior to 1982, wastewater was discharged into the Flint River, and at times the discharge exceeded the river flow. Most of the area was a 25 to 35-year-old mixed pine hardwood stand, kind of typical of the Piedmont, and the soils were typical of the Piedmont. They were largely candy udalts. Shallow surface, clay-textured subsoils, slopes ranging from 6 to about 25%. Wastewater was applied at 6.4 centimeters per week as a design, so you turned a Piedmont site into a temperate rainforest, really. And the nitrogen application rates were designed to be up to 594 kilograms per hectare per year, with phosphorus at 329 kilograms. And the wastewater was applied through a system of sprinklers like you see here, about, you know, over 1,400 hectares. So what the system looks like at age 22, it's still there. You have your trees still there. There have been changes in species composition. You have a kind of a grass understory. But, you know, it functioned for 22 years, or actually longer than that. And the reason we know it functioned is if you look at those constituents that we were trying to protect, this is what we get. This is the groundwater quality in the Clayton County Land Application System, beginning sampling before the wastewater application began, and then for over 10 years after wastewater application began. These were internal wells, not wells at the edge of the land treatment system. The drinking water standard is 10 milligrams per liter. If you look at the average over those periods in this really high period here, it never got much above 0.5 milligrams per liter. So from a groundwater protection standpoint, the system functioned. Similarly, if you look at the drinking water, or if you look at the stream flow from Page Creek, we didn't have data before the start of the system, but you see from the time the wastewater application began, we can look at the nitrate concentrations in Page Creek and compare them to two nearby creeks, and again, the nitrate concentrations are quite low, well below drinking water limits, and from that standpoint, the system seems to be functioning quite well. Now, we also got a little information on some of these other pathways that are important in design. One was the tree biomass response and nitrogen content. And on the left, I show tree biomass for the irrigated and non-irrigated, the green being the irrigated. And on the right, I show nitrogen contents of, again, this is a pine, mixed pine hardwood area of the site for the stem and the crown. And you see that there is a dramatic increase in nitrogen content with irrigation, and that nitrogen contents are really quite high compared to what we would normally expect for loblolly pine. So we got a response, and we did get nitrogen uptake in the vegetation. I'll get back to this in a minute. We also looked at total soil nitrogen. This is after 20 years in the soil. So we augured down and took these samples. And again, when we took these samples, what we did is we went to irrigated areas and non-irrigated areas on the same hill slope and just got in the wetted and non-wetted areas and looked at nitrogen. And you see this dramatic increase in nitrogen storage in soil depth that was there after 20 years, mostly in the surface 10, 15 centimeters where there's a lot of earthworm activity, not much below that. But if you look at that, that storage is 335 kilograms per hectare. So it's not non-significant. It's not insignificant. I had a couple of students, Chaley Hoover, who's now with the Forest Service, and Mercer Medding, that came back and did some study on denitrification using large chamber systems on the hill slopes, mid-slope, and toe slopes. And again, we saw a huge response in terms of denitrification on the irrigated slopes. There's a change in scale that's a tenfold change, okay? So the upper graph shows the non-irrigated 0.6, and the lower graph shows the nitrate concentrations in milligrams per meter squared per day at 6. And so those are quite different. And we saw it across the entire landscape, hill slope, mid-slope, and toe slope. We actually came back later on and looked at the riparian areas as well and put that into a kilograms per hectare per year. And even though there was an increase in denitrification, if you look at those numbers, you know, maybe 10 kilograms per hectare per year being denitrified, even in the riparian areas, it was where the denitrification rates were high, about 40, it still, on a landscape basis, wasn't that great. So denitrification numbers we have. So if we put these values into that original design, I have on the left the design that you could have done based on the 1981 manual. My right shows the measured actual pathways, and I've converted stream flow and groundwater flow, making some assumptions into the quantity. And you'll see that, you know, biomass uptake, 25 kilograms per hectare per year, like an order of magnitude less than the design manual would have allowed. Soil storage, which you don't get credit for, even after 20 years, was significant. It was almost 40 kilograms per hectare per year. Denitrification, about 10. I made some assumptions for leaching to groundwater and stream flow. You notice that those numbers sort of come out to be similar, all right? That's only measuring nitrate, nitrogen concentration, about 20 kilograms per hectare per year. I got a lot of nitrogen I can't account for. It's possible that ammonia volatilization actually is not non-existent, but actually exists on this site. My suspicion is that we do get some runoff, particularly in wet areas when the system's mismanaged, and we never measure ammonia in these systems. So if you have most of the wastewater is going on as ammonium, if you're not measuring it, you're not going to detect it, right? So that's my net annual balance. So if I left it like that, you would probably think, well, Moore's just messed up in all of his measurements. Well, there are some other studies that kind of show the same issue. This is the work done at Rotorua. I never can actually say that forest name, so I think everyone just calls it the Waka Forest. Is that correct, Dan? Yeah, okay. I'm not going to say that, but whatever Dan said. So this was municipal wastewater from Rotorua. They applied wastewater to a commercial Pinus radiata forest. The soils were andesols with a high P absorption. Again, they had irrigation, and they had measured a number of things over the years. These pathways that they measured were summarized by Mark Tomer in 2000 for the Forest Alternative 2. And what we see is they're designed wastewater and they're measured. And I'll just point out a couple things here. If you look at the biomass uptake, you know, the New Zealanders weren't fooling around. They knew what the nitrogen uptake was for radiata pine, and they got it pretty close. Look at soil storage. Even after fairly long term, over 170 kilograms per hectare per year change in soil nitrogen concentrations. And that's modeled as zero in the design. And it's a good thing, because if you look at their denitrification, all right, and their wetland denitrification, and their ammonia volatilization, you know, they're not very high either. So they didn't find much. And they also did some calculations for leaching to groundwater and stream export. And because of the way they did the calculations, the numbers work out pretty good. But the pathways, okay, were quite different. The third case study I'm going to talk about is in the Mountain Lake Hotel in the Jefferson National Forest. This was work done by Jim Berger not that many years ago. He was applying wastewater from a hotel complex to a mature northern hardwood system. The soils were these sandy, stony soils derived from colluvium in the Ridge and Valley. They were on the hilltop. The experimental rates that he applied included the design rate for the system as well as the actual high rate that they might actually think about applying. So I don't actually have the design for this system. Jim couldn't find it when I talked to him, and I'm not sure it was ever published. But if we use the EPA design manual, we could see that if you use half of the biomass uptake that they might say for northern hardwoods, and just use that as your design uptake, and then look at the denitrification, ammonia volatilization, and leaching to groundwater, you would get a net annual uptake of about 152 kilograms per hectare per nitrogen. What Jim actually measured when you looked at both the low rate and this kind of higher rate of wastewater application is that they had, you know, not that much nitrogen being applied, but they not only did they not get any soil storage in this system, the application of the wastewater on this dry hilltop site actually mobilized native soil nitrogen, so that when you look down at his net annual, you know, uptake of nitrogen, it's a negative. He actually mobilized inherent nitrogen and didn't get any renovation of nitrogen in the system. So those are three examples that just point out how important knowing the pathways and knowing something about your soil is. That's for nitrogen. Well, heck, phosphorus is easy, right? We know what happens to phosphorus. You put on the wastewater, it gets in the soil, gets absorbed in the first couple of centimeters, get nothing leaching. You might have some plant uptake, but it's not important. And this sort of is how the EPA manual presents it. This is a really nice diagram that Louis Schipper sent me, so I like that diagram of matrix flow. But, you know, basically what the design manual says, put it on, it's absorbed by the soil, don't worry about it, nothing's coming out. And indeed, if you were to do that then, what you would assume is, okay, how do I design my system? Well, you do a Langmuir absorption max to see how much phosphorus your soil will absorb. You divide it by system life, and you come up with how much you can apply per year. And that's exactly the way the designs were done in the 81 manual. And you would get acceptable loadings of 400, 500, 600, 1,000 kilograms per hectare. We also have data from that Roto-Rooter study for phosphorus. And this is, again, a slide courtesy of Louis Schipper. But if you look at it, you see that they applied fairly high rates of phosphorus each year. They have highly strongly fixed soils in the andesols. And if you look at the phosphorus that's coming out in the stream that was draining that system, you don't see much of anything, no matter, even despite these high phosphorus application rates. And if you look in the soil, indeed, it behaves exactly like you would expect for Darcyan flow through a high phosphorus absorption system. If you look at the control, which is in the red, and that's without irrigation, the more irrigation you apply, you know, the more you get retained in the soil, and as you start filling up the very surface, you start getting that phosphorus moving down a little bit deeper. But you see nothing below 60 or 70 centimeters moving out. I said, aha, I wonder how Clayton County did. So I went in and we augured to 50 centimeters, and You know, I looked it out and we made some estimates of how much pea was applied over 20 years, and I only account for about 450 kilograms. I'm saying, darn, I missed it again. However, you know, the whole system sort of depends on that Darcyan flow, and I remember sitting in some of these sessions and you all telling me that we don't get Darcyan flow in forest soils. So I said, well, maybe we ought to look deeper. And remember, we have these are clay soils where we have a very strongly structured BT horizon. You get a lot of preferential flow. And flow probably looks more like this and like the picture in the right, okay? So, if I went deeper in my soils and started looking for phosphorus, what did I find? Well, you have to have graduate students from Brazil to do this because no one else is going to auger down 3 meters. But if you can get a student to do that, you find that you go through that kind of strongly developed clay horizon where you're getting a lot of bypass throw, and on a bulk level, you don't see much change in phosphorus. But when you get down into that BC or CB, where things are starting to become less lower hydraulic conductivity, a more matrix flow perhaps, you start seeing this accumulation of phosphorus. And we could almost explain everything that we had applied by looking deeper in the profile. All right? Now, sort of in recognizing this, the 2006 manual actually included a second component to look at. Not only do you look at lifetime loading, but you look at rate of flow. And so if you have a high, you can make some assumptions about rate of flow, you could find that instead of applying 400 kilograms per hectare per year, you might only apply 40, depending on the saturated hydraulic conductivity. Now, is this important? Well, I took data from various sources, some work that Larry West had done, some work that I had had available to me from Dalton, and some work that Rhett Jackson and his students did up at Coweta in that area. And I took and did two types of evaluations of phosphorus retention on an annual basis. On the left, I used the original approach using their actual phosphorus sorption capacities. And I would come out with that I could get an acceptable loading based on lifetime limitations in system life of about 200 kilograms per hectare per year. When I actually plugged in the KSATs that Katie Price reported for forested mountain soils and put those in and made some assumptions looking at the contours of a typical land application site, it turns out because of the rate term in this, in the bypass flow, I could only apply 23 kilograms per hectare per year. So, soils are important in looking at these design flows, even for phosphorus. I don't know how much time I have left, Russ. 10 minutes? It's got to be getting close. Okay, because I'm gonna answer questions. So what we see is that the designs work, but they don't work the way they've been designed, right? Now, this is important because if land application was the new thing that people were excited about in the 1980s, really phytoremediation is what people are excited about at the turn of the millennium, right? And there have been some guidance documents in terms of how we look at phytoremediation. These are all over the web now. Are there any similarities? Well, yeah, there are. I would suggest that if you look at sort of the phytoremediation pathways that are associated with arborescent vegetation, we have phytoaccumulation in the tree. We have phytodegradation that can occur in the tree depending on the particular contaminant. We can have phytovolatilization. We can actually have contaminants move through the tree and be volatilized out through the leaves. We can have volatilization off the soil surface, okay, just like we would consider that happening with ammonia in a forest land application system. We can also, for that matter, just control hydraulic gradients with phytopumping because of the additional transpiration rate. In the soil, we can have rhizodegradation depending on the contaminant, and we can also have stabilization and retention in the soil. The key thing I want to point out here is that these first remind me sort of about looking at nitrogen renovation pathways in these systems. But there's a little bit more, because you also have this kind of role that the roots of the tree have to be sort of interacting with the contaminant. Okay? And this is really easy to do if you're an illustrator for a phytoremediation manual. You take an 80-foot tree, and then you put 60-foot of roots under it and spread it out. And you got interaction. And these are just two illustrations from two widely cited and utilized phytoremediation manuals. And that, of course, is not how tree roots grow. And the problem with that is, if you're an engineer who are usually responsible for putting in the phytoremediation programs, they look at those diagrams and they say, oh, I have a wall that's going to protect my contaminants from moving off-site. And then I say, no, you have a phytoremediation zone, it's not a wall. And 2 seconds later, they come back and say, I've got a wall. And I say, no, it's not a wall, it's a zone, and it may not even be where your contaminant is. So we have this problem with, like, okay, we've got these designs going out, we have all these pathways, and we have the issue that we have to make sure the roots are actually where the contaminant is. So we had some papers today. You know, you have easy phytoremediation sites, right? You have a low slope, an open soil surface, it's shallow to the contaminant plume. You plant your cottonwood, you've got something that's going to be taken up and either phytovolatilized or degraded, and you really don't have any problems, and these systems are sort of the easy systems to work with. Then we have what I would consider challenging phytoremediation sites. You've still got an open soil surface, but now your groundwater flow is too deep for the normal distribution of tree roots, which is like 90% of the fine roots are in the surface, you know, 15 centimeters or 20 centimeters. So you really want to attack that groundwater before it gets out to the creek that's over here to the right. And there are indeed some systems that have been developed. This one happens to be the patented tree well system, where you plant trees at the surface, you do something within the planting hole to make sure the tree roots can't actually grow out where they want to near the soil surface, and you provide a medium. In some cases, you do some special things to make sure there's oxygen down at depth, and you try to get those roots to grow down into the contaminant plume. My former student, Herbie Goldman, works with this. He says that they've had great success with it. I assume they have great success growing the trees. I honestly don't know, because I haven't seen any data, how well those roots are actually reaching into the contaminant plume. And then we got the character-building phytoremediation sites. Don't laugh, because this is a site I worked on. And this is typical of most brownfield sites. Most brownfield sites are not bare soil that you can just go ahead and till and plant, right? They've got concrete places, asphalt, old tank farms, whatever. And you're trying to do something to kind of do your final polishing of wastewater coming off that site. So this was a site where I could show you the direction of flow. There was groundwater. It wasn't particularly deep. It was like a meter or a little bit less in some cases below the soil surface. You had a tank farm that would be to your right, and then you had a stream, which you can see over here to the left. And they had done some work to phytoremediate chloro and dichlorobenzene, but they wanted to put in something else to sort of polish that groundwater and kind of do a little bit more to that contaminant plume. They said, well, let's do phytoremediation. And I said, sure, let's go ahead and tear up this concrete, and we'll go ahead and plant eucalyptus, because we had done some work in the lab that showed that it would work. Unfortunately, he said, nah, you can't tear up that concrete, because we're really worried about, like, remobilizing other stuff. And so, no, you got to do it with the concrete in place. And you look at it and say, are you crazy? They said, no, we're not crazy. We want you to do it. We're going to. So in this case, we were able to look. We actually had holes bored in the concrete like that. And because the concrete had a fairly large layer of large gravel underneath it as a subgrade, and the soils were a coarse texture, or reasonably coarse textured alluvium, we drilled holes. We did a lot to the planting holes to try to make sure we composted them, we pea-fertilized, we did a lot of other things, and planted eucalypts. What do you think that looked like after a couple of years? Any guesses? How many people think that everything died? Raise your hand. That's what I actually predicted. And instead, after 2 years, we have 5-meter-tall eucalypts. And, you know, I'm as amazed as you. But it turns out that if you have the right engineered systems, perhaps we can get roots to grow and trees to survive and do some of these phytoremediation projects on character-building sites. So sort of in conclusion, what I wanted to say is that forest land application systems work. Some of these systems have been in place for over 25 years, and the groundwater and the surface water that's coming off them is still acceptable. They're still working. In fact, they might have been designed for 20-year life, and now they're going into their second 20 years. However, the EPA and accumulation rates that are included in the design manual are unrealistically high. That's just not happening. Denitrification, which we always talk about, is pretty much a minor pathway. And I can't really say much about ammonia volatilization because no one's ever measuring it in a forested system. My guess is that when you spray wastewater onto a forest stem, that you indeed might get some significant volatilization. It smells like that at times, but I don't have numbers for it, and nobody does. Long-term changes in soil N, which are considered zero in the long-term designs, shouldn't be. They can go positive quite well, they can be zero, or they can actually contribute nitrogen. P loadings based on equilibrium P absorption really ignores water flow pathways. And this has been largely corrected between the 81 and 2006 manual. However, many designs don't use field-based saturated hydraulic conductivity measurements to do their designs. They use the data that comes from the NRCS Web Soil Survey. And as a consequence, designs can be based on land, you know, kind of that absorption max, when they really should be based on the flow pathways. All right? And I think all LIS designs can probably be improved by more detail and renovation pathways. And this is particularly true when we start thinking about things other than nitrogen and phosphorus. When we have boron or we have some sort of pharmaceutical or something else we're trying to handle. If you don't know the flow pathways, you really can't say if it's going to be renovated or not. Phytoremediation. I'm guessing there's a need to confirm and quantify the remediation pathways under field conditions. A lot of work's done in the lab. Aaron, raise your hand. We're guilty of this, right? Not so much in the field because it's very difficult to do. That needs more work. And I really think we need to incorporate a realistic understanding of rooting patterns and how to encourage rooting growth on character-building sites to have effective phytoremediation programs. And this is something that the people in this room are particularly should be involved with because, you know, if anyone knows anything about tree rooting patterns, sort of like this division in this group does, and we ought to be working much more with engineers and designers in looking at how phytoremediation can be improved. So that's my talk. I don't know if I'm within time or over time, Russ. Okay? All right. I would be happy to take questions because I had 20 more slides with a lot of really small data that I was told by my wife, Sue, you can't include those. So I took them all out, and I'll put them up on the website if you'd like. So are there any questions? Yes. Exactly.
So the idea is, of course, to keep the profile erosion.
Mm-hmm.
So would you expect the profile is erosion?
No, actually, the way the systems are managed, and this becomes an issue with phosphorus, the way the systems are managed is that they try to create a fairly like pulsed load of water. So they have a period of nitrification occurring under aerobic conditions, and then the loading in the slope positions creates an area of anaerobic conditions where you get denitrification to occur. That and the combination of the riparian wetlands that are usually associated with these. So that's the way systems are managed. They used to try to manage it with equal kind of sprinkling, and they found that that did, in fact, not give many denitrification. The problem with that approach comes to phosphorus, right? In phosphorus, you really want that contact time to have soil absorption of phosphorus. And if you load, oh, say you load an inch on or an inch and a half on, you start exacerbating the movement through those preferential pathways and actually decrease your contact time. So if you have a phosphorus problem that you're trying to address, it would actually be better to do what you suggest, to have these short, short irrigation intervals that not allow saturated flow never to occur. And that's actually one of the suggestions that for handling some of these systems that might have phosphorus problems. So yes, that's the way they're currently managed. The other thing that we do have some data. Larry, were you on Phil Freshman's committee when he looked at those subsoil horizon KSATs? What? No, okay. Phil Freshley looked at some subsoil horizon KSATs in the Clayton County system after it had been operating, like, I think, about 15 years. And what he found is over time, he might have actually been exacerbating preferential flow through small movements of clay particles down under the heavy irrigation that clogged some of the smaller Darcyan pores that water would have moved through. So it actually exacerbated that problem of maybe getting preferential flow through the subsoil. Other questions? Yeah, Marty. Okay, so we actually report CO2 evolution values in the paper by Mercer Medding, and you do get a very significant jump in CO2 evolution, but I expect that we actually had more carbon transport in the streams as soluble organic carbon that we didn't measure. One of the things we did find that there were times, because when we did the riparian denitrification studies, we were also looking at soluble organic carbon. There are times during the year when you expected the conditions for denitrification would be ideal, that we had a carbon limitation on denitrification, soluble carbon limitation on denitrification. So I can't really answer that question other than to say they might have been important at times during the year. Yes. That's true as well.
I work on the Penn State system, and ours is 8 milligrams per liter.
Okay. And typically, if this would, there'll be times when the second, most of this application is gone through, at least it's gone through secondary treatment. And so you're really looking at kind of a tertiary treatment on a forest land treatment system. So the BODs generally are going to be fairly low. And that may, in fact, be why you get these carbon limitations at time for denitrification. Other questions? Someone has to argue with me. We can't account for a bunch of nitrogen, and we augured as deep as I could get anyone to auger, Larry. Okay, best guess in my gut is that I have never seen a land application system that doesn't have some rapid surface flow or some runoff, okay? And many of these systems, if they're not very carefully engineered, they're actually going into variable source areas, and they're actually expanding the variable source area and then irrigating into it. So I expect some of that loss is actually as organic N, maybe not organic N, but certainly as ammonium N, because most of it's going on in the ammonia form. My gut also tells me that we do have ammonia volatilization. It's a very slow but steady rate. I don't think it's zero. I think it's probably greater in many cases than the denitrification. So those would be my two guesses. It's really funny. Matt Callahan, I did sort of a dry run on this presentation, and Matt Callahan, many of you might know Matt. He's a Forest Service scientist. He works with earthworms.
And I came to this, I can't account for all the nitrogen. You know, we looked in a lot of places. He said, you know, how many earthworms do you have? And I said, we have about a 10-fold jump in earthworm populations on this site. And he said, you're standing crop? And I said, you're a standing crop. And he said, well, how about birds coming in and just pulling those earthworms out and moving them off? He said, that's going to be at least as much as your denitrification. So I have to admit, I haven't looked at earthworm mitigated transport, but apparently it's there. Other questions? All right. Well, yes. Yeah, that's interesting because when these systems were designed in the 80s, what they were looking for was ammonium sources because then the soil could absorb the ammonium and you wouldn't get pulses of nitrate moving off. And yes, those operational changes are important for municipal systems, but industrial systems, they're crazy. I worked with Wade, brought me up to an industrial system that they were having problems with, and the soils were just not accepting any water. Well, sort of unbeknownst to anybody, they had gone from a calcium source to a sodium source for their alkali source, and they sealed the surface, you know. And it's like, well, what do you do now? I guess you call Malcolm Sumner in and have them put gypsum everywhere because their system was messed. All right. So, yes, thank you. Before Russ comes up here, I just wanted to make two quick thank yous. I really wanted to thank my major professor from my master, Al Leaf, who's passed away, Bill Pritchett, who out of the kindness of his heart took me as a graduate student when he should have known better, and then Earl Stone, who had to stand in for Bill because Bill's got worn out and went away for sabbatical right in the 6 months I was trying to finish up my dissertation, and Earl had to stand in for him. So I really appreciate them passing down Wild's legacy to me. And I would be remiss if I didn't also say something about the memory of my students who helped me so much in terms of getting out papers and working, but passed on too early. And that would include Bob Mamone, who worked with Weyerhaeuser Corporation, Kim Ludovici, who was with the Forest Service, and did a lot of work on roots with me and at the Forest Service. And one of my more recent graduate students, Jim White, who worked with Larry West and I on an SMZ project. Without graduate students, we can't do anything. We wouldn't have a career without our graduate students, so they're really important. I want to remember them. Okay.